The opposite of motivation, abolishing operations, are the topic of today's conversation with BCBA, Corey Robertson from Florida Institute of Technology. Thank you so much, Corey, for accepting the invitation and joining me in today's program.
Oh, my pleasure.
I would love to talk to you about abolishing operations and actually motivating operations, but the other side, because when we talk with people about motivation and what motivating operations actually are, we are usually focused in everyday life on this one side of the coin, which is motivating operations and we establishing operations, but we also have the second side, right?
Yeah, the abolishing operation. I think, you know, there's the analogy, of course, is of deprivation and satiation. But those terms tend to only work for certain kinds of reinforcers. So I can be deprived of ice cream, and I can certainly eat enough of it that I'm satiated. But I don't ever think of myself as being deprived of escape. You know, that's a weird way to talk about it. But the idea is of wanting and not wanting. And so when we're trying to evoke behavior, we're trying to set the conditions for someone to engage in a specific response, we want to make them want the outcome of that response. But the same goes true, especially in dealing with challenging behavior, that there's plenty of times that we don't want the person to want the outcome. And a great example of that is attention. If a child is getting frequent attention, in the environment, just because of the nature of the environment, then they don't want attention as much, and they're less likely to engage in those challenging behaviors that produce attention.
Absolutely. So abolishing operations can help us, actually, if we consider what can be an abolishing operation, it can actually set us for success when we want to either evoke or abate behavior.
Correct. Yeah, I think, you know, once you've determined, especially when you're dealing with challenging behavior, when you're looking at somebody who's doing something that we would like them not to do, the question becomes, well, why do they do it? What do they get from it? And I think a big question that ties in with that is, well, why do they want that so bad? And I think a great example of that is you know, in classroom settings with demands. You know, when we have children who want to get out of that classroom, they don't want to do the work, they don't want to do what they're being asked to do. My first question is, well, why do they want out so bad? What's so bad about this environment? What's so bad about the work? What's so bad about the situation that the person wants that escape? And if we can change that and make that environment not so bad, then they don't want escape as badly, and they're not likely to engage in those behaviors. And that's exactly what we're talking about with abolishing operations, is lowering the value of the reinforcer. You know, I worked in a group home with adults with developmental disabilities, and there was a gentleman who was stealing food from the refrigerator, which I thought was an odd thing to say anyway, because it's his home. And how do you steal food from your own home? But he was reaching in and sneaking things that maybe he shouldn't be eating at odd times of the evening and stuff. And so my first question is, well, you know, how do we make him not want that so badly? Let's give him snacks more often that are appropriate. So I just offer him something to eat. And if he's having things to eat, then he doesn't engage in challenging behavior. I understand you work with animals quite a bit, and my understanding is that dogs need a lot of exercise. They need activity. They need to be running around and be engaged. And if you have a dog who lives in an apartment or in a home where they don't get that loud exercise, they're likely to engage in some challenging behaviors too, right? They'll tear things up and park upon and seek your So, but by giving them a healthy dose of exercise, non-continually, just as part of their routine, then they're less likely to engage in those problems because they don't need exercise as much. They're getting them.
Yes.
So those are all examples of abolishing operations.
Absolutely. So if we think about abolishing operations, we think about the antecedent condition that is influencing the consequence, the value of the consequence.
Correct.
We are changing the setting, the antecedent environment, so that the behavior we want to, for example, decrease, is the consequence for this behavior is not so important, as you said with an example of the gentleman. So if he got his food, more often. The snacks were more available, and he was more able to have them throughout the day. There was no need
for exactly.
stealing.
Yeah, I think, you know, I try to teach that in our classes with the idea that the best defense is a good offense, right? So when it comes to dealing with challenging behaviors, you want to nip it in the bud. You want to be able to make the problem go away. You know, you make the problem behavior irrelevant. If I don't want that thing, then I'm not going to engage in behaviors to produce it. It's just not an issue anymore. So if I, for example, going back to the classroom setting, if I'm getting help, and if demands are phased in or faded in, and I'm eased into the routine, and if there's a lot of support and there's a lot of reinforcement going on, then I'm just not even interested in escape. It's not on the table. And I'm not going to be engaging in behavior to try to get out, whether it's disruptive behavior or aggressive behavior. There's just no reason to do it because I've got everything I want. So I think that's what we look at in those situations is, well, one approach anyway is to say, hey, how do we make the problem behavior irrelevant? How do we take it out of the equation? And generally that just means meeting people's needs before they have to engage in the kinds of behaviors that they've learned to do to be successful. And that's really the trick about problem behavior, right? The challenging behavior is that person's being successful. They figured out a way to get what they need out of the world. And we just wish they would do something different. And so when you really look at it from the person's perspective, then it becomes a question of, okay, so what is it that they want or need? How do we help them get that in the right way? And that's usually a good approach, is to meet their needs before they have to do something to get it. Or again, teach them appropriate ways and you prompt those behaviors ahead of time. If you want to escape, raise your hand and take a break, or raise your hand and ask for help and we'll give you the assistance. You don't have to throw the book at the teacher or yell at a student or anything like that.
So basically we can either change the value of a consequence, or we can teach a person how to access the consequence, but with a different
view. Oh, I lost you.
Can you hear me now? I think I will check my connection, but it's okay. Can you hear me now? Oh, you froze.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, I checked my
connection. Are you back?
Yeah, I'm back. Can you hear me?
Okay, I can hear you now, yes.
Yes, so I was saying that to change the behavior, we can, to change the situation actually, we can either change a behavior and teach a person to access the consequence, but using a different behavior, or we can change the value of this consequence.
Correct. Yeah. So, you know, when I think about the value and reducing the value of the consequence, I think of that as, you know, making the problem behavior irrelevant. I don't want that anymore, so I don't need to do things to get that. The second approach that you're talking about is teaching an alternative behavior. And what you do there is make the problem behavior inefficient. So now this behavior that we don't want the person to engage in is no longer the best way for them to get what they want. Right. And so that's where the matching law comes to effect, which tells us that we're going to spend more time doing behaviors to produce more reinforcement. And so when we teach an easier skill and we reinforce it at a higher rate, and at the same time, of course, we're trying to reduce the rate of reinforcement for the challenging behavior, then the odds start to stack in our favor. So that's the second approach, would be to make the problem behavior inefficient. It's just no longer the best way to get what you want. So why bother doing that anymore?
Yes, if there are easier ways to access.
And then the third way, you know, is just to make the problem behavior ineffective. And in that we use extinction procedures where you just don't get what you want. But there are problems with that, because when we're first ineffective, the first thing we do is try harder.
Yeah.
And so that's not always a viable solution for a lot of reasons. And, you know, in the example of demands, I see that most often where people will take the approach that, well, by golly, this child has to do what we tell them to, and they should be compliant. And we're going to teach them that they just can't get escape. And we're going to push them, and we're going to, ride them until they just learn to give up and do what we're asking them to do. And the analogy I use to it's interesting, again, that I know of your animal background. The analogy I use to this is in taming a horse. One way is you jump on the horse and you hold on as tight as possible, and you teach that horse that nothing they do is going to get you off of them until you break their spirit, right? That's the old way of horse training. You break the animal spirit and they learn to give up. And that's really what extinction looks like. And it's ugly and it's messy and it's sometimes it's mean. And so, but the other way is to approach it from the front and say, well, wait a second, rather than just teaching this child that there's nothing they can do to get escape, why don't we ask why they want to escape so bad in the first place? What's so bad about the demand? What's so bad about the work? Maybe they need additional help. Maybe it's the way we're presenting it. Maybe there just aren't enough reinforcers to doing it. We can fade in demands. And that's more analogous to fading in the saddle, which is what I understand that good horse trainers do, right? Is they start with a blanket and they get the animal used to that feeling, and then they start to bring in the body weight and those kinds of things. So we ease them on into it. It's a kinder, gentler way of achieving the same effect, which is to have people tolerate situations that might be uncomfortable at first.
Yes, this is so, because like behavior is the principles of learning and behavior are the same for every species. So it's the same with non-human animals. And the example with a horse, but also with dogs, that there is this old school that says your dog has to listen to you. And no matter what you do, the dog has to listen and you have to make him listen.
Yeah. So,
that there is no way, if you say sit, the dog has to sit. And you have to make him sit. And we don't think about, okay, so why he doesn't want to sit in the first place? What is so bad with this situation that your dog tries to escape the situation?
Right.
And escape, so abolishing operations are often related to escape and all the behaviors we consider challenging and problematic, because we want to reduce the value of this consequence for those behavior.
Yes. And I think it also applies to attention-seeking behaviors. You know, we have people who frequently engage in attention-seeking behavior, then the answer is to give them a lot, many times anyway, the answer is to give them more attention, if you can, for just being there. Access is the same thing too. You know, if somebody engages in behavior to get access to activities, is it possible that you can give them access more frequently if it's not a problem, like access to play or access to games or other activities that we engage in? So we're less likely to engage in problem behaviors to seek it out. You just give them what they need or what they want. Now, sometimes it's not okay. Like if you're in a school setting, you're supposed to be there to work. But you might have to start off by allowing more opportunities to play, and then you can thin that schedule a little bit, and you get more work than play, and you fade there. Yeah. One of the things I was just talking about in supervision with one of my supervisees is the notion that sometimes we have to make compromises when things aren't going well. So when we have a problem situation and we're at our wit's end and we're pulling out our hair about the situation, and sometimes it's nice to say, well, okay, would this be an improvement? With this, so right now they're not doing any work in the school day. What if the child was willing to work for 10 minutes? Would that be an improvement?
Yeah,
it would. Okay, well, what if they worked for 10 minutes and then they got 30 minutes of activity time? Well, wait a second. You mean you want us to let them play at school? Well, for now, yes, to get the 10 minutes of work out of them. You just said that was an improvement for what they're doing now. Now they're not doing any work. So yes, I'd like you to let them play for 30 minutes just to get 10 minutes of work on now. And then we're going to start changing it until we can get more work than we do play. And eventually we'll get them to the point where they expect to work all day just like we want them to, or they should do, or whatever. But sometimes we have to be willing to say, okay, well, how bad is it now? Will we accept a little bit of improvement? Let's try something and let's do something and see what we can get,
Yeah, this is really interesting, because it shows that we can actually achieve the same outcome without using extinction.
I think so, yeah. Now the problem is, I think that sometimes if the problem behavior is still getting the reinforcers, you're gonna get some rate of responding, but we wanna shift the balance, and we can do that without extinction. And you just don't get the negative side effects. You don't get the extinction burst, and you don't get the aggression and those kinds of things. There's more than one way to go about that. And the truth of the matter is that we're seldom effective in producing extinction, pure extinction anyway. There's what we call bootleg reinforcement, which just means that the person gets away with it. They sneak it. Somebody messes up. Somebody makes a mistake, that kind of thing. So, but the good thing is, again, going back to the matching law, it just states that as long as there's more reinforcement for this behavior, you're going to see more of this behavior. So it's okay if you get a little bit over here. The person still gets success sometimes with the problem behavior, but it works out better for them to do the behavior that you want them to do. So that's really what we do, is we tilt the scales in our favor. you know, you mentioned about making the dog sit, and I'm under the impression, this comes from working with humans, but I think it's still true for animals as well. I don't think that we're in the business of making anybody do anything.
Oh,
yeah. We're in the business of making them want to. So it's interesting that you selected motivating operations as mm-hmm. the first topic, because that's really the secret, is how do we tilt the scales in our favor by making people want to do things? That's what we're adept at doing. That's what a good behavior analyst does, is look at the environment and say, how can we tilt the scales in our favor? How can we make this person want to do what it is we want them to do?
Yes, because it's actually, if you want to change a behavior, if you want a person or an animal to present the behavior, then you need to have those motivating operations work. Because if you don't, then you don't have any means to how to increase the value of a consequence of that person involved in the behavior.
Right. And you know, again, it always ties to the consequence. So an operant conditioning, yeah, operant conditioning is really about the consequences. That behaviors produce environmental changes, and those changes either strengthen or weaken the behavior. But we have to understand the antecedents related to those consequences. So when we talk about motivating operations, it is, again, those are antecedent conditions that determine how effective that consequence is going to be. And so we need to understand that to use them, to wield them effectively. But you still got to have the consequences there. So, you know, making somebody want something doesn't matter if they can't get it when they engage in the right behavior. So we have to always make sure that we're following up with the consequence side of things.
And the about the abolishing, establishing operations, it's not always only about food or unconditioned reinforcers, right?
No, there's all kinds of things, you know, that there's definitely learned motivating operations. I talk about that all the time. For example, many people would relate to me, I am a couch snacker. When I sit on my couch and watch television, I want to eat. Why do I want to eat when I'm sitting on the couch? Because that's the place I always do it. So the best way for me to avoid evening snacking is to stay away from my couch, just to don't turn on the TV, and I'm much more likely to do that. Or, you know, things that we do that we tend to do together. So, you know, wine pairings and things like that are all conditioned motivating operations. I'm eating this type of cheese and that makes me want this type of wine, you know, or something like that. There are definitely those situations that come in with that too. Yes, and they refer to all of our reinforcers.
Mm-hmm, because
and punishers too. We don't think much about punisher abolishing and establishing operations, but they're definitely there as well. For example, if the environment is boring, timeout has no effect. Timeout is not an effective punishment if you don't really care about where you are anyway. So that's one example of thinking about abolishing operations related to punishers. If we have to use punishment, we don't like to, but if we have to, we want them to be effective punishers. Mm-hmm. And so we have to make sure that those establishing operations are in effect, like loss means mm-hmm. something when you're losing something valuable, you know.
Okay, so if we talk about punishment, the abolishing operation for punishment has actually the opposite effect that it has on the reinforcement.
Correct. Yeah, the value altering and the behavior altering effects are in the opposite directions, which makes them tricky. That's right. So when we strengthen a punisher, mm-hmm. when we establish a consequence as punishing, we're less likely to engage in the behavior. So for example, if you have no money in your bank account, getting a speeding ticket is very punishing. And so we are much less likely to speed if we don't have any money in the bank account to pay for the speeding ticket if we get one. On the other hand, if we win the lottery, I don't care about the speeding ticket at all, and I'll run right past the police officer because I can just pay the ticket when I'm done. So that would be the establishing operation for or abolishing operation for punishment. In that case, I'm rich. I don't care about a ticket. It's just a slap on the wrist, and I'm going to engage in behaviors that would produce that punishment. Sure. Athletes, I think, experience this with the use of cortisone. You know, if I don't feel pain, then I'm more likely to engage in behaviors that might produce that pain. Right? Like running out back on the field because they gave me a shot of something and I can't feel it anymore. Whereas pain usually would suppress any behaviors that would cause that muscle strain or something like that.
Absolutely. So with abolishing operations and both punishment and reinforcement, we are working on, we need to remember that we are working behavior, because very often, and all we talk about is related to behavior, because very often I think people get mixed up with a little bit of internal causes of behavior. Mm-hmm. And this it's getting wound up with emotions, and that people do something because they engage in a problematic behavior because they feel some way.
And right.
We should, if we use abolishing operation, we should make them, for example, feel different.
Well, it might, but I think that we generally describe feelings as states, right? So when you say somebody feels upset, well, how do you know they're upset? It's because of the way they behave. Now, certainly I can identify my own emotions without anybody having to detect them, but those are behaviors too, and they're still subject to the environmental factors, you know? So we feel and we think certain ways because of environmental events. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we need to be aware of those. The feeling is behavior. It's not an explanation for behavior. And I'm going to give you a good example of that, you know, I see, so people will, and so often children will throw a tantrum or lash out when they experience a situation that's frustrating. So let's say, for example, that a child asks to go outside and play and it's raining, and the mother says, you can't go outside, it's raining, and the child throws a little fit. And people will say, well, the child behaved that way because they were upset.
Yeah.
And my question about that, and you know, again, it's nice when you do have a bit of an animal training background, because it makes you sort of strip away some of the higher level things and get to the basics. Mm-hmm. And when you look at things from an evolutionary perspective, it becomes very interesting. Why it take the energy to engage in that behavior when you're upset? If you're upset, why not just sit still and conserve energy and be upset? Why lash out and cry and whine and all that kind of stuff? Well, it's because there's an environmental consequence, right? So they're not crying. Yeah, they're not crying because they're upset. They're crying because in the past, crying has led to a repetitive outcome. They've gotten something they wanted. Now, maybe it's that in the past when they've cried and whined about something, the parent has given in and said, oh my gosh, just go outside and play. I don't care. You get wet, you know, or something like that. Or, and in some cases, maybe it's just, I can't get what I want, but I can make you feel the same way that I do about it. So if I cry and whine and behave in a negative manner, then your face expression will change and you'll say, stop behaving that way. What's the matter with you? And I go, one for me. Now we both feel mad. I can't go outside and we're both upset about, you know. So, but there's a reason for doing that that has to do with environmental things. It's not the feeling. We say that they're upset because they're crying and whining, but they're upset because they couldn't go outside. And they're crying and whining because there's a possibility that they might change that outcome. Or more precisely, in the past, they've probably been successful in changing the outcome. But that's true. The thoughts and the feelings are part of behavior. And that's a very frustrating thing to let go of. It's a life-changing, I think, or a perspective-changing realization that the thoughts and the feelings are not the cause of behavior. Yeah. They are behavior. And we have to account for them as well.
Yes, I think this is like a very big miss. People are so they're holding so tightly to the thing, to the thought that emotions are the cause and everything that goes inside the brain is causing the behavior, not the environment. Mm-hmm. Because I think it also helps you to kind of take the responsibility, because if something is inside you, then you have no way to change it. So it's like... Yeah, it's like with dogs, for example, if you say a dog is dominant, then you don't have, how can you change a dominant? I mean, there are no ways to change something that is inside the dog. You can only change the behavior.
Yeah, I think good ways to change people's perception on that or their thinking on that is just to ask questions like, well, how do you know? Or what does that look like? So they're dominant. Well, how do you know they're dominant? Well, because they're aggressive towards other animals. Well, why are they aggressive towards other animals? Because they're dominant.
Yeah.
How do you know they're dominant? Well, because they're, wait a second, you see what we're doing? We're going in a circle and we haven't really explained anything. Mm-hmm. Now, why does it benefit the dog to be aggressive towards other animals? You know, that kind of thing. And the same thing goes with those emotions. Well, how do you know they're upset? Well, because they're crying. Well, why are they crying? Because they're upset. Well, wait a second, which is it, you know? is understand that those are thoughts and feelings too. And I think it's a very positivist view. You know, one of the things I love about behavior analysis is it does give us hope, because if I say, well, this person's just a jerk, what can we do about that? They're a jerk. That's who I am, right? That's the way I was born and this and that. But if we realize that, no, it's not that you're a jerk, but you're behaving in a jerky fashion. And if we can change your behavior so that you no longer behave that way, then people will no longer call you a jerk.
Yeah.
And isn't that a wonderful, enlightening, positive way to think about things, is you don't have to be that way, because if we change your behavior, we wouldn't call you that. And I hear that all the time when a teacher or parent says, you know, they're like a different child now, right? this is a different dog now because you've worked with it. Well, why are they different? Because they've changed their behavior. You know, when we talk about personality, I think that really we could describe that as a tendency to behave a certain way under certain conditions. Those personality traits and things like that we ascribe to are really just names for patterns of responding. Mm. This person is assertive. This person is neurotic. You know, what we're really saying is there are ways that they behave under certain conditions that are predictable. And that's the beauty of behavior, is that really when you get down to it, it is predictable. And that means that we can influence change upon it.
Yes, and it doesn't mean that behavior analysis disregards and says that emotion they don't exist, right?
No, right. Thoughts and feelings don't exist or aren't important. No, we have them. We know that emotions do exist and thoughts exist. We have them. We feel them, and they're important. But we need to understand and deal with the ways that they influence behavior, and they might sometimes influence behavior. But the fact that they are behavior and they're influenced as well. You know, and a great example of this is my wife and I are very close. We were best friends long before we got married, and we find that we have the same thoughts at the same time. Mm-hmm. Right? We watch something on TV or hear a little bit of music or something, and I'll say something and my wife will say, I was just thinking the exact same thing. And it happens all the time. And I say, why? Because thoughts are behavior and they're evoked by environmental events, and we have similar learning histories. Yeah. And we have similar interests and similar reinforcers. And so, yes, we have the same thoughts at the same time, many, many times. And emotions too. And the other thing, and I've become more interested in this lately, is acceptance and commitment therapy, mm-hmm. which you may have heard of. And it's a branch of psychology, but it's based on behavior analysis. And it deals with our thoughts, and it deals with the way that we use language and the way that we perceive our world through language. Okay. And what that does is really make you start to realize that your emotions are behavior. And that means they're subject to change and they're subject to analysis. And so we can say, why am I having this feeling right now? Why am I having this behavior? And do I wish to change it, or is it acceptable? And so we start to learn that thoughts about negative things aren't necessarily negative, right? A thought about a bad thing is not necessarily a bad thing. It's just the thought. The event is bad, but the thought is not necessarily bad. And once you do that, you really start to become happy, I think, is really what that ACT is seeking to do, is help people become happy by taking them out of their fear and their discomfort, because we spend so much time thinking about the world and things that haven't happened yet or have already happened that we're not present, you know, we're not in the moment. And the analogy I've read, I think, and this is really interesting again, is that when an animal becomes, it becomes aroused when there's a threat. So when a rabbit, for example, hears, you know, something in the brush a ways off, its ears go up, its hair stands up, you know, it's in that mode because it's dealing with an environmental event that could be danger. Humans are the only species that I think we know of that can create that danger with our thoughts. I can think about the tiger even when the tiger's not actually in front of me. And the effects are all the same. My heart rate increases, I perspire. You know, so we live in a state of almost constant stress because we're creating those events for ourselves with our words. But the words are not the things themselves, right? The words are not the thoughts themselves, not the events themselves. And so once we realize and we can separate that I can think about this without having to feel the way I do when that thing is actually present, it's very freeing. And so it ties in with that notion of, you know, thoughts and emotions as behavior. That means they're subject to the same principles of behavior and we can deal with them.
Yes, it does. And it also makes me think, because when you said that if we think about, for example, a tiger, and we feel scared And by that, I mean, we have an increased heart rate, we are sweating, then we can also say that it's a classical conditioning process. So can we say that thoughts have been conditioned as a simile that elicits all those respondents' behaviors?
They can, the words themselves, yeah. So, you know, when you say the word tiger, I think you think of teeth. And you think of that, and that can cause those reflex responses. And that's one example, but just thinking about your boss yelling at you about something you did, or thinking about a project that you haven't completed yet, and all those kinds of things create those behaviors. So, yes, I think that there is a respondent process there, that the words, which are just, that's all they are, is words or thoughts or stimuli, they have the associations with the events, with the actual things that they represent. Mm-hmm. And so they have those similar effects on it, sure.
But it's also related to the particular learning history of an individual, because tiger can be a stressful stimuli for you, but it can be kind of a joyful for me, because, for example, I work with tigers and I have all positive experience with them.
Sure. So the word tiger has completely different connotations for you. Right. Exactly.
So it's just like what we, this is also, it goes back to the fact that it is all in the environment. It doesn't happen in a vacuum. Its behavior has to be, and this environment is not only limited to our skin, as Skinner said, right? It's also right. Inside.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that we can describe emotions from perspective of operant behaviors, because sometimes they are learned, but big part of the emotions is related to the reflex responses.
Definitely, and as parents, sure. You know, and that's why we have to understand those processes as well. Even as applied behaviorists, we need to understand classical conditioning or respondent conditioning, because it happens. And many times when we talk about phobias, anxiety, those are reflex responses, and they serve a purpose. You know, they serve an important purpose. When your blood is pumping, you're ready for fight or flight. But the problem is sometimes the stimuli get associated with those with those reactions that don't need to be. I give an example. My son was, when he was 15 years old, had no interest in learning to drive. And I found that very odd, because, you know, ever since I knew that a car was a thing and that you would one day learn to drive, when I wanted to drive a car, I wanted to learn how to drive so I could be free. I could go see my friends and go do what I want to do. So here he is, you know, he's been 15 for 6 months and he's been old enough to drive, and he has no interest in driving.
Yeah.
And it finally dawned on me what the problem was. And the problem was, when he was 13 years old, he had his first driving lesson with my wife, and he hit a pole. The second he stepped on the gas pedal, he jumped the curb and hit the pole, and was traumatized. And I didn't think about it, because everybody was safe. Nobody was hurt. And he's you know, a little bit like me. I think he's kind of rough and tough on the exterior and doesn't show his emotions very well. And so we had no idea that he was afraid, but indeed he was. And once I realized that, the approach became clear. And so one day we got home from driving somewhere, and I took the keys out of the ignition, and I said, I want you to come sit in the driver's seat.
Okay.
He said, oh, I don't want to do a driver lesson. I don't want to drive. And I said, no, but listen to me, just come sit. Come sit in the driver's seat. And he sat there, and I said, how do you feel? And he said, stupid. Can we go inside? I said, okay, but do you feel nervous? No. Do you feel anxious? No. Good. You're behind the wheel of an automobile, and you don't feel anxious. That's it. Goodbye. And we went out of the car. And I did that again. The next time we came back from somewhere, I made him sit in the front seat. How do you feel? Stupid. Can we go inside? Yeah, but do you feel nervous? Do you feel anxious? No. Good. And then eventually I left the key in the ignition, but the car wasn't running.
Okay.
So now he's got the key dangling against his leg as he's in the wheel. Put your hands on the steering wheel. How do you feel? This is dumb. I feel fine. Good. And what we did was graduated exposure.
Mm.
Is I, you know, faded him back into that situation where there was no fear. And then I was able to say, okay, now the vehicle is running and you have your hands on the steering wheel. Put your foot on the brake, put the car in drive, and just let go of the gas pedal and let's see what happens. And if you don't like how fast the car is going, pump the brake and the car will stop. And then he was fine. But I, you know, this was respondent condition that was going on. It wasn't operant. Now he engaged in operant behaviors to avoid those conditions. And that's the thing, they get combined. So if I experience anxiety because of the sight of a vehicle, now that's respondent, mm-hmm. but I will engage in operant behavior that helps me avoid that situation.
Mm-hmm.
like saying, I don't want to learn how to drive. I don't want to
escape behavior.
It's escape behavior to avoid those situations. Mm-hmm. So the interaction, the intersection of operant and responding conditioning happens all the time. And we need to understand those processes too, so we can approach them correctly.
Yes.
So I think anytime that we're seeing fear, anxiety, those kinds of things, we need to be sensitive to the fact that there are other processes, the learning processes that are going there as well, that are pairing processes that happen.
But we can actually, this is really like great that we can change what we understand by emotions.
Yeah.
And it felt like you feel that way, like your son, he felt that way about the cars, the vehicles, and he will feel that way all the time because it's a feeling. If we understand feelings as behaviors, we have actual tools to change it and influence it.
Yeah, and I think that the other thing, again, when you recognize feelings as behavior, then you can separate them. You know, my daughter came, but we just had a nice long weekend, and my daughter came up to me on Tuesday morning. She was supposed to be up for school, and she was upset, and she was crying, and you know, she's 13, and I gave her a hug. I said, what's going on? What happened? She says, I don't know. I'm just sad and very anxious. And I said, okay. I said, well, did you have a bad dream? No, I don't think so. Okay, so you don't know why you feel so anxious? No, I just do. I said, well, how about splashing some water on your face? Let's go get through your morning routine, and maybe that will get you out. And she said, well, I already did. I took a shower this morning. I said, okay, well, that's odd, and I don't know why you're feeling this way, and that's okay. But, you know, this feeling is going to pass, and it'll be okay, you know. And so separating that is, I feel a certain way right now, but that's okay. It's going to pass, and that feeling will go away, and that feeling's not currently related to anything going on. Right. There's no danger present. So I'm going to ride this out, and it's going to be okay. I'm okay to feel this way right now. And I'm going to have a hug from dad, and then I'm going to start eating breakfast, and maybe I'll feel better in a few minutes. And so I think that's important too, is to sometimes be able to recognize this is how I feel about it, and it's okay. And the same thing goes with other feelings too. You know, I've had conversations with people where I say, hey, I'm upset about something, and I want to share that I'm upset with you, realizing it may not change the situation.
Yeah.
But this is how I feel about it. And that feeling is probably going to go away eventually. I'll be worried about something else in 15 minutes. Yeah. But right now I'm angry about this, and I want to share that with you and then move on. You know, I've said what I said, and that's it. You know, I think those are healthy skills to have that require that we are able to identify our feelings and the sources of those feelings and why we're feeling that way and whether they're going to do us any good.
Absolutely. But it's important to know that if we use behavior principles, we can change the behavior we see. It gives us the possibilities to not only see it differently and not get stuck into this, because if we get stuck in a concept of emotions or in a concept of a personality, then we are out of any tools we can use. It makes us, I think it also goes, it's again, the situation like this, if you say that, I'm just a shy person. And if you just say that, and I don't feel well around people, and because I'm shy, then you're kind of like letting go of options that will allow you to change it. Because
and programming yourself. Right, and you're programming yourself. When you say things like that, you're really describing a set of behaviors, and you're telling yourself how you're going to behave before you even behave that way. Yeah. I'm shy. I'm not comfortable around people. Well, what does that mean? Like, okay, well, now you've said that. What are you going to do about it? You know, if you keep saying those kinds of things, then you're bound to keep behaving that way. If you start telling yourself, hey, I'm nervous about talking to people, but I'm going to overcome that, and I'm going to say hello to a new person today, well, then you've said that differently. It's kind of like putting something on your calendar. If you set something up on your calendar, then you're more likely to go do it because you put it on the calendar. Mm-hmm. So I say put good things out there for yourself. Say good things about yourself instead of bad things. And, you know, if you're going to program, and that's really what that self-talk is, you know, when we create those rules for ourselves. And because we've become so accustomed to words accurately describing the environment, we unfortunately are able to shape our own environment. So, you know, if you start off by saying, I'm going to have a bad day today, it's a pretty good chance you're going to have a bad day today, you know? So I think we have to learn to recognize those kinds of things and change those patterns and say, oh, why am I having this thought? Well, I'm saying I'm going to have a bad day because I'm late for work and I'm in traffic. This is just happening right now, though. It doesn't have to affect my whole day. Once I get to work, maybe it'll be great. So let me change the way I'm thinking, you know, and that, recognizing that those are just thoughts. Those are just emotions. I think it's what you do with them that matters.
Yeah, so if we are thinking about our own behavior and if we want to change it, then we can also use motivating operations, both abolishing, establishing, related to the consequences of our own behavior. And we can shape our behavior.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, and it's funny that I'm talking so much about RFT today and ACT, but that, you know, what ties in with that when we talk about our own behavior and our thinking and feelings is our values. And so our values, to some extent, I think become motivating operations, right? So I value having new experiences. Mm. And so if I value having new experiences, that means I need to be willing to go outside my box a little bit and not say things like I'm shy, I'm nervous, I'm not going to have a good time, because I value people and friendships. And if I value friendships, then that behavior is not in line with my values. So that's, I think, some way that we can change those motivating operations related to our own behavior. Absolutely. Just by thinking about what is important to us and what our reinforcers are. And sometimes those statements can affect the value of those reinforcers to some degree.
Yes, and those values, if we think about behavior of another person, we simply need to sometimes teach the value and create a value. Because like with money, I think for a small kid, money has no value. Like for a toddler. Right. It doesn't have any value because maybe a toy has a value that was bought with money, but money itself is not really a valuable thing when you're a toddler.
So right.
It has to be taught by the environment.
Correct.
So we can actually teach the value of consequences.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. We pair up, we pair reinforcers, you know, we have to establish reinforcers. And those happen in a variety of ways. So when you're able to get the things that you want with money, you quickly learn that, oh, I need to have some of this money around because that helps me get the other things I want. When you learn that the auditory sound of a clicker means that a snack is going to follow, you very quickly start doing things that produce clicks, right? Because the click indicates that the treat's coming. Attention is very reinforcing to us, but that's learned. You know, we learn very early on that when people are looking at us, generally good things follow. So we learn to seek out the attention of others and then become reinforcing in and of themselves. I don't think most people spend too much time looking at money and holding money and rubbing money against their face and things like that. Money's actually really a dirty thing, you know? So it's not with the money itself, usually. It's what you can do with the money, you know, that kind of thing. And that's some of those reinforcers are the way that they allow us to get other things as well. A corkscrew is not nearly as reinforcing as it is when you have a wine bottle that you need to open with, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. So those become valuable because they help us get other things, you know.
Absolutely. And with also with non-human animals, you also, like you said, with a clicker sound, we pair those reinforcers. And we establish them, and we establish the value of consequences. But I think what people also confuse is that you need to use, at least with animals, that you need to starve the animal sometimes to make it value the food. And of course, if you are satiated, then there is no value in food. But also, we need to consider that there are many other reinforcers available, not only food, both for humans and for animals.
Yeah, definitely. Touch and attention. You know, I will admit that I'm not the best when it comes to the animal training. I have a dog, and sometimes usually she does her own thing, but she comes around sometimes and she doesn't need to go outside and it's not time to eat. And she just literally wants to be around me and have me better and pay attention. I realize, I've been in my office all day with the door shut because I was busy teaching and I didn't spend any time with you today. And you really just want to be close to me. Isn't that interesting? But dogs do crave that attention, and we do too. And the other good thing about that is we don't tend to satiate on it as much, you know, and that's why we like to use those kinds of reinforcers. One of the things that I hear a lot of concern about with humans, not so much with animals, but with humans, is the use of food reinforcers and artificial reinforcers that aren't part of the planned activities. And that's a valid concern, but because, you know, when we do things, it's generally for, you know, attention, recognition, grades, you know, whatever, these other social constructs that we've created. But, you know, a lot of times you have to get somebody there. You have to get to the point where that means something. I had I was working with a mother many years ago, and she had a young toddler. I think he was maybe 1.5, 2 years old. And he would tantrum so badly in the department store that she couldn't go shopping. She was embarrassed to take him anywhere, and it was miserable. And again, for taking the approach of, okay, well, what does he want, and what do you want, and what can we do about this? And I said, so what would you like him to do? Mm-hmm. And she said, well, I would like him to sit in the cart quietly. I said, okay, now we know what we want to have happen. How long will he do that now? And she says, well, maybe I get like 5 minutes before he does that. I said, okay, so here's what I want you to do. At 3 minutes, I want you to reach in your purse and pull out a little snack, a little M&M, a little Skittle, a little something, and give it to him. And I look him in the eyes and say, I love the way you're sitting quietly.
Okay.
And do that. And then I want you to give it everything. And the reason I said that is because this young man was very young, and attention was not yet a reinforcer. He didn't really care about praise so much. Words didn't mean as much to him as candy did, right? But we started there. And I said, now, once you got that going, you can just use the praise statements. And by golly, it wasn't very long. In fact, I even offered to go with her to the store to do this with her and give her feedback and watch her. And she said, oh, no, that's okay. I think I understand what you're saying to do. And she came back and she said, oh, my gosh, Corey, you're a genius. It worked. And today I was able to go to the store with no candy and no tantrums. And I said, why are you thanking me? I didn't do anything. All I did was give you a suggestion. You put it into place. You take responsibility. But very quickly, she was able to fade out. You know, the praise became the M&M. Mm-hmm. And then what that means is, in the future, that child's likely to be finding out how he can make his mother happy. Because when he makes his mother happy, then good things are going to happen for him too. So those are you know, what we call condition reinforcers, praise and other things like that. But the thing is, we don't tend to satiate on those as quickly. You know, I don't know anybody who's ever said, oh, I'm just so sick of people telling me what a great job I do. I just, that doesn't mean, you know, I don't ever get tired of people saying, thank you, Corey, you helped me learn something. Or, you know, no, we don't get tired of that, you know, as much.
Yes, so. Absolutely. And also with conditioned reinforcers, we also tend to, like, when we use first, like in the example you gave with food and a praise, because you condition them, right, together,
right. Like
the praise, then we can, from those primary reinforcers, when we use them, then we can actually switch to the natural reinforcer that occur in the environment.
Right.
So we make the learner ready for living in the world, actually.
Right. Yeah, we want to get to those natural reinforcers that are going to sustain behavior. You know, our job is done when we're no longer required as behavior analysts. And so we do need to think about what the natural consequence for that behavior is going to be and get them there. But sometimes we have to start somewhere. And so that's why when people say, well, I'm worried about the use of this, or I'm worried about the use of that, I don't want to give food for behavior and things like that. Well, the first thing I say is, have you ever been to a social function that didn't have food? You know, you go to a business meeting, a PTA meeting, a church function, there's food there. Why? Because people like food, you know. But the other question is to go back to is, well, what are you doing now and how's that working for you? Well, he's not doing it at all. Okay, so if we could get him started, wouldn't that be an improvement? Yes, it would be an improvement. Okay, so are you willing to sacrifice the value of not using food as a reinforcer for the benefit of getting him to engage in the behavior? I suppose so. Okay, good. And then we'll get to the point where he loves doing it. Reading is a great example. People would be very concerned about giving people rewards for reading.
Okay.
Because you should want to read, right? Reading is its own reward, the content of the book. But you have to learn to contact that. If you don't read very much, then you can't encounter books that are engaging and wonderful and exciting. And so how do we get the person there? You got to have something else in between to get them to that point. So we use the reinforcers that they are interested in now so that we can then fade them out eventually and have them contact the real reinforcer. You know, I had to let my son experience the joy of driving. Mm-hmm. I had to get him there. Then I didn't have to convince him to want to drive. Now he drives everywhere. You know, he doesn't need my permission. But, you know, but I had to get him over the fear, first of all. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you got to get him in the position where they can contact the reinforcement.
Yes, absolutely. It's so similar to the animal world and training animals, because often people say that, oh, this is like a bribe and I don't want to use food all the time. I mean, he's lunging on other dogs, he's barking, and why do I want to use food in a situation like this? And this is what you described, like, you have to start somewhere. Of course, we don't want for eternity walk your dog with tons of food and giving him all the time the food. But you need to start somewhere and you need to build it. So, because this will still be better than what you do right now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the other thing is too is their animals probably have more limited reinforcers than humans do, because they don't have language. Yeah. They don't play video games or have a social media or those kinds of things. Now they play. The animals definitely play. Animals definitely enjoy attention and things like that. But it's nice to be able to have discrete reinforcers and powerful reinforcers. And that's the thing is, you know, it's the ability to deliver that reinforcer immediately. In fact, you know, that's one of the reasons that they use tag teach and acoustic and clicker training and things like that, because you can deliver the click even faster than you can deliver the pellet. You know, it's hard to deliver that one piece of food as fast as you can deliver the click. But if you can get there immediately and reinforce that behavior immediately, then we can start to see change. I think it's a fair concern. It's also cumbersome, but it works, you know. And that's sometimes the question is, well, you know, it might not be the best thing, but is it better than what's happening right now? You know, well, I don't want to give the dog food. Okay, well, do you want the dog to continue biting and lunging at other animals? Well, no. Okay, so which one's better? You know, which one's worse? And pick your battle, and then we'll get there. You know, the dog should learn, and then the joy of walking will be the reinforcer, because we're going to stop immediately if the dog starts to lunge, right? And then you can't move forward, and you can't smell other things, all that stuff. So it's tricky. Animals are challenging because we don't have the benefit of verbal behavior. But in that, there's simplicity and there's beauty. And, you know, even working with individual humans with language difficulties and language delays and things like that can be almost simpler, because there's less of that other stuff to muddle with. Mm-hmm. Because what happens when you get in a highly functioning individuals and people with verbal behavior is we think that telling them things will change their behavior. And I would imagine that you find it when you tell your dog owners what to do with their animals, it doesn't change their behavior. And when I tell my staff what to do with that child, you know, the telling them really doesn't change their behavior. I have to show them how to do it. I have to have them contact the reinforcers for doing it. And of course, in that case, the reinforcer is the change in behavior. So the teacher's reinforcer is when the student changes their behavior. The dog owner's, you know, reinforcer is when the dog changes their behavior. And it's our job to help them contact those reinforcers. We got to help them get there. Telling them doesn't make a bit of difference. I mean, it's helpful. Sometimes it works, you know, but very seldomly do words get the job done ultimately. So it's almost simpler and cleaner to work with animals without language, because, you know, language is helpful, but a lot of times it gets in the way. And it, you know, ties back in with our whole thing about thinking and emotions and how we perceive our world. That's all just, I mean, you know, the dog is just here. I mean, the dog is just the dog, you know, and that's the funny thing about it. There's a great cartoon with that, right, where I think that there's a man and a dog,
yes,
a sunset or something, and the guy's thinking about all these other things, and the dog's just thinking about the guy in the sunset. You know? That's the beauty of it. They're just present.
Wow, that's a lot in this conversation I'll be thinking about. And just to sum up everything we talked about, it's like, well, behavior analysis is about, it's like the beautiful thing you said, it's about creating the wants, the needs in people often, right? To want something, to change the behavior that these people want to do it, not to make them.
Correct. Yeah, and I think, you know, the bottom of the root of it is to improve the human condition or the animal condition, because I would say that there are certainly animal behaviors are still applied behaviorists. Mm-hmm. But when you look at applied behavior analysis, you know, the purpose of us being in this is to improve our world, improve the world for people, to change people's lives in a positive direction. And so when we say that we want to make them want to do things, mm-hmm. it's not that we want to make them want to do things for our benefit.
Mm-hmm.
It's that we want to make them do things for their benefit. We look at somebody and we say, this person isn't happy right now because of this situation. They're missing a skill, or they're engaging in some challenging behavior, which is making it difficult for them to be successful. Or, you know, in the case of working with, you know, pet owners, their dog is becoming aggressive and violent, and it means that they can't take them out anymore, and the dog can't enjoy its life anymore, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And that's when we come in and we intervene. So our drive is beautiful. You know, we're people that want to help the world improve and help people improve their lives. And we're just doing so through a very systematic scientific approach. You know, we're just looking at the relationships between behavior and environment, mm-hmm. and then arranging the environment to support new behavior. That's what we do. In fact, I think we're probably better would be described as environmental analysts than behavior analysts. But I think that job title is already taken.
Yes, and also we also change not only one person behavior, but very often it's like if one person in the family is showing some problematic behavior, challenging behavior, then by helping the family, you help all the people in it. Like with a dog and dog owners, you not only help the dog, but you also help the people because they are also in a challenged position.
Oh yeah, definitely. We're changing everyone's behavior. You know, when you go into a school setting or a home setting, you're not just changing the individual whose behavior is hard. You can't, because their environment consists of other people. And so you have to change everybody's behavior. And it also means that we have to be very aware of our own behavior. And it continues affecting our behavior, because if we're going to influence change, then we need to be a part of that change. And they're not the only ones who are impacted. You know, I think that, you know, when I say that we change other people's lives, one of the things I share with my students is that my life has been profoundly changed as a result of that. In giving me a profession, in making me able to provide for my family, in putting me in touch with amazing people like yourself who ignited by this passion to help people. So we benefit from it too. There's a little bit of a selfish endeavor in it as well, right? I love the feeling that I get when I help change somebody's life. And I love how much my life has been changed as a result of that as well. So the wonderful thing about the environment is it actually consists of other people too. So it's very difficult to separate environment and behavior. What we focus on is perspective. So we say, well, if we're changing this person's behavior, then we need to see how everyone else's behavior is part of their environment. If we're changing this person's behavior, then we have to recognize how everyone else in the environment is part of their environment, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Wow. Thank you so much. It has been really a great pleasure talking to you, and it was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Anytime.
Okay.
You don't want to miss the next episode with Ryan Cutledge from Animal Training Academy. Follow us, subscribe to be on time with the next episode.